mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's easy to tell the villain in an old Western. The good guy wears a white hat and the bad guy wears black. Real-life villains don't follow the code, nor are they likely to conspicuously twirl their mustaches like Snidely Whiplash awaiting the oncoming train. Sure, Hitler was evil, but what is the nature of villainy? Bill Clinton, Joe Frazier, and the Sharon Stone character in Basic Instinct each attract haters. But does that make them wicked? And what is the nature of villainy? Why does Taylor Swift inspire cultish adoration while Wilt Chamberlain is loathed? And why is our culture so absorbed with the anti-heroes anyway? Chuck Klosterman writes about sports and popular culture and is the New York Times ethicist. He explores the nature of badness, in a bad way, in a new collection of essays called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. Chuck Klosterman, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
So like most kids, you were drawn to heroes when you were younger. When did that shift for you?
I think all young people, unless they are, you know, the proverbial bad seed, have a very simplistic view of good and evil when they're young. So many children's stories and really the way parenting works sort of sets up a very clear dichotomy between what is good and what is bad. So when you're a very young person, you don't really have much confusion over who you root for, and who you root for is sort of who you relate to because it's aspirational. As you mature, you start, I think, gravitating toward sort of the concept of the antihero, and then eventually you're a full-on adult and what you like is no longer a way to create yourself. It's sort of a way to understand yourself. And at least for me, there just became a point in my life when I would watch a film or read a book or watch a television show or follow politics, whatever the case may be, I inevitably found myself somehow understanding and feeling closer to the people I consciously knew were the villains. Hmm.
And you developed a sort of fascination with con men, like D.B. Cooper, who you write about in the book. This is a man who hijacked a plane in 1971, demanded $200,000 or said, I'm going to blow up the plane, but somehow inspired a cultish following, sort of like a folk hero. How?
Well, part of the D.B. Cooper story that is just, I think, especially sort of interesting now is the idea that a hijacker of an airplane could be seen as heroic. I mean, you know, you would never have that experience now. But, you know, there was a real hijacking culture in the 60s and early 70s. It was strangely common, and the assumption would usually be that the hijacker would just say, you know, take us to Cuba, you know, whatever the case may be. The passengers knew to just sit there and be calm, and then they would all be returned. The D.B. Cooper thing was an interesting situation because this guy brings a bomb onto a plane and, you know, has all these demands and wants this money and then jumps out of the plane. So he has a real sort of dramatic story. And because he was never found, he kind of went from being a criminal to this folk hero. So he is someone in the book I talk about who is a villain who's not a villain. Like, he did a villainous act and yet everyone loves him.
Your definition of the villain is one who knows the most but who cares the least. So who else is in the club?
First of all, when you're trying to write a book like this, when you're kind of working through ideas that are very conceptual, you're always looking for like a unifying field theory. And the closest I come is this idea that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. Now, this is not perfect. There are certainly exceptions to this, some very meaningful. I mean, Hitler is a meaningful exception. Hitler is not someone who knew the most and cared the least. He cared about everything and didn't know anything. But for the most part, you know, what really bothers people is the idea of somebody who just has no emotional investment in what they're doing and yet is sort of effortlessly skilled at manipulating people or sort of controlling society or attaining whatever success that they want. Here's somebody who actually is not in the book, but who I saw a documentary the other night on Lee Atwater.
Uh-huh.
I really wished I'd written about him because he's almost a perfect example of this. You know, he's this guy who was the architect of the Republican Party through the 70s and 80s and early 90s, did a lot of sort of diabolical things.
He came up with the Willie Horton campaign, right?
He came up with the Willie Horton campaign. He would sometimes just blatantly lie about people's, like, past mental illness or whatnot, you know, a lot of problematic things that within the context of politics were not only acceptable but very successful. But the most interesting thing about this guy to me is that he became a Republican arbitrarily. When he was a young man, he knew he was interested in politics and just saw more traction on the conservative side of the spectrum. If it had been reversed, if the nature of America had been different, he would have become, you know, a Democrat. And to me, that's like the ultimate manifestation of this kind of theory, the idea that this person who understood politics so well, he knew he could succeed and yet had no interest in really being engaged what that success meant.
And they're the people with the kind of swagger. I mean, Lee Atwater is a really great example of it. There's a kind of cynicism in choosing sides just based on what he thinks he can get out of it. And there's a special attention that you pay to those who aspire to villainy, the Aleister Crowleys, and the late 1980s hip-hop band N.W.A., whose real name and most famous song we can't say on the radio.
You know, there is a difference, though, between like an Aleister Crowley character and N.W.A. The fact of the matter is, Aleister Crowley actually believed he had to do all these evil things in order to, I guess, be authentically villainous. Like, you know, when he was a young boy, he once killed a cat in 9 different ways, the same cat, just to test the theory of, does a cat really have 9 lives? You know, he believed he had to eat all the drugs. He believed he had to push his mother-in-law down a flight of stairs because she represented this idea, this concept that he had to be against. What's different with N.W.A. or, say, the Oakland Raiders of the 1970s or you know, perhaps even someone like Andrew Dice Clay is that they aspired to have the perception of villainy. They saw the kind of the utility in being against whatever the culture was. It's really a kind of a form of adopting the counterculture. It's, you know, it's very strange because when someone is a villain on purpose, people don't really believe them. They see it more like a theatrical move.
It works in some places, I guess, in others. And that's one of the things I kind of took away from this book, that a Muhammad Ali, for example, he comes away as the sort of beloved character, while Joe Frazier, who worked himself up from, what, the cotton field, becomes the despised one. Why so fickle?
Well, you know, it's really like a good question. Can I totally explain it? I can't, but I find it very fascinating. I find it fascinating that Muhammad Ali, during his kind of 3 defining fights against Frazier, used incredible racist language against Frazier and basically positioned him as a black fighter fighting for white America. And, you know, with Ali, it's particularly complicated because outside of this window of really kind of reprehensible behavior, he's probably the most important athlete of the 20th century in terms of race relations. So then it becomes a question of, is it really a balancing act? Are we trying to look at someone in totality and trying to go, well, okay, most of what they did was good. They did this one terrible thing. Can we excuse that? But it goes further with figures who are sort of this towering in the culture. Muhammad Ali, I almost compare a little bit to John Lennon. You know that, you know, John Lennon has a real problematic history with women. I mean, his own kids have talked about remembering John Lennon hitting his wives, you know. But as a Beatles fan, and I'm one of these people, it's almost like we don't want that to even be part of the story. It's not something we factor in to sort of go like, well, you know, this person is complex or life is complex. We just sort of want to disregard it. And, you know, with Ali, I think part of it had to do with his pure confidence, sort of his unadulterated bravado that forced those around him to sort of accept that, well, he's a progressive no matter what he says. You know, no matter what the message seems to be content-wise, we know as a figure he is the progressive. And over time, the progressives always succeed because, you know, the culture evolves too. And anybody with progressive ideas, no matter how strange they may seem at the time, are eventually going to seem completely valid. Another example of this are like the weathermen, okay? In this day and age, when people bring up the weathermen, it's usually with a positive connotation. You know, there was a documentary called, you know, just like The Weathermen, where they were pretty much described as being like very attractive, very idealistic, interesting people. In some ways, the most intellectual extension of the counterculture of the 60s. And yet at the time, they weren't seen that far from, like, the Manson family. They were seen as a totally fringe, problematic, anti-government, anti-social organization. But because their ideas were progressive, we look back on them positively, almost discounting what actually happened.
You mean the weathermen, like the Weather Underground, kind of that,
yes.
that group of the
yes,
the
not meteorologists.
Right.
People's meteorologists have basically remained the same in culture over time.
Chuck Klosterman is with us, and he's talking about his new collection of essays called "I Wear the Black Hat: Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined." Well, not to mention that Muhammad Ali is an attractive man, and there is something that you point out here that a lot of Bernard Goetz, for example, who was for about 5 minutes, a hero, the subway vigilante who shot 4 youths on a subway train in New York in the 1970s, doesn't make out so well being a weird looking guy. Linda Tripp obviously doesn't make out so well not being a very attractive person through no fault of her own. But how much do looks have to do with the perceived villainy?
Well, I'm probably especially sensitive to this because I'm a very weird-looking person. And I think that if you're a weird-looking person, the sort of the understanding of how much handsomeness and sexuality plays in interpersonal culture is really maybe amplified. But, I think that this is an interesting problem because, if you say to someone, do looks matter? Do looks impact how people interact? Everyone will say, well, of course, yes, they do. Everyone knows that, But we've been conditioned to almost reduce the degree to which we accept how much physical attractiveness actually plays in terms of what we find acceptable or unacceptable. I have an essay in this book where I'm talking about the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky situation. Mm-hmm. It would be very easy, I think, to say why was Bill Clinton able to sort of have this event happen in his life, basically be the world's most famous philanderer for a period of time? He really, in a weird way, put the presidency at risk for this kind of one desire that he, again, had no emotional investment in. And of course, the first response somebody will have to that is, well, that's just this double standard we have that men can get away with this and women can't, And there's certainly some truth in that, but the attractiveness of Bill Clinton was a role in this as well. I don't think Nixon would be allowed to have had that kind of experience and been re-embraced not just by America as a whole, but specifically by women. That Christmas, he had the highest approval rating of his entire tenure as president. I talk about Ted Bundy. I don't talk about a lot of serial killers in this book because they're not really villains. They're more like subhuman monsters for the most part. There's not really a polarizing element to Jeffrey Dahmer or Ed Gein or something. But, Ted Bundy is interesting. He's the good-looking serial killer. Mm-hmm. Whenever people talk about Ted Bundy, they always mention his handsomeness. And he was played by, a good-looking actor in a made-for-TV movie. And it's sort of like a problem that's so present in our lives, we almost ignore it because it reflects too weirdly on human nature.
Well, in addition to being a slightly weird-looking, or let's just say a person who didn't care very much about his appearance, I'm going back to Bernard Goetz, just because he talked. He filled himself out as a person. He let us know who he was and what his motivations were, which really turned everybody off. And you make that point here. It's the people who talk. It's the Wilt Chamberlain who talks about himself. It's Linda Tripp who decides to talk about herself. Is it better just to stay silent, to keep a heroic kind of poise?
The silence is part of it, certainly. But it's almost even a larger abstraction. It's the idea that people don't know anything about you, so they can fill you kind of with whatever their pre-existing desire happens to be. Bernard Goetz shoots people on a subway. Okay, initially, if you go up to anyone who's intellectual, somebody who has a supposedly sophisticated view of culture, and say is vigilante justice acceptable? They will say no. Of course not. We have a framework for this. People need due process. You cannot allow an individual to decide what justice is. But then you give them a situation without many details. All you know is that there's this person in a city filled with crime, bothering no one, confronted by three potential criminals, and he kind of responds with violence. When that's all the information we have, it almost seems like he is acting as an agent for society, that here is somebody who is actually doing what everybody else would want, or maybe that he's making the world safer by, shooting people in public. It seems paradoxical, but that's the initial sense of Bernard Goetz. The first 48 to 72 hours of those shootings, when Bernard Goetz was on the loose, you really couldn't find anybody who had a problem with him. It was like he was an unknown hero. But once he comes forward and he says things like, I wanted to kill those guys. Shooting them was easier than typing. It was like, he had showed no remorse. We start learning details about things he said at a community meeting that were potentially racist. We find these bizarre things about his life. For example, he still lives in New York in an apartment with squirrels in it because he's a big advocate for squirrels. We learn all these sort of interesting details about him. But what that does is it makes his actions now seem personal. He no longer seems like he's an agent for society. He seems like an agent for himself, and that forces everyone to swing back to the original idea that you just can't let the lone gunman decide what is right and what is wrong.
You make the point in the book that we say thank you to the convenience store clerk so that we can be seen as the kind of people who say thank you, right? We're invested in people knowing what we like or dislike. So how much of the hero and the villain is a projection of how we want to be seen?
Oh, I think certainly almost all of it. I mean, this book is like all of my kind of essay collections. It's not as though I'm trying to persuade people to believe a certain thing about villains or heroes or anything. I'm not like that. I know that's kind of antithetical to criticism in some ways, but I have no desire to be like a tastemaker or to shape public opinion. I'm trying to explore these things on my own. Like, something's interesting in my life, and I feel like the best way for me to kind of work through my consciousness is kind of through writing about it. So, a lot of this book has to do with my own fear that I am a bad person regardless of what I do. That my motive is the motive is the real problem here. Like, you talk about the person in the convenience store. You go buy a bottle of Gatorade or whatever, you pay the guy, and you both say thank you to each other. If neither one of you mean it, is it still a positive act? Or is it a performative act? Is my reason for being a good person solely because I'm afraid of being viewed otherwise? So a lot of what I think about in this book is not even what happened, but why it happened to begin with. Like, what was the intent? And then how is that intent sort of manipulated by the audience?
But if we go back to that idea of the villain is the one who knows the most and cares the least, you care, right? I mean, you admit that being emotionally fragile is an important part of being a successful critic. Maybe that's not the music critic that you are anymore, but you do care. You're fragile. You have a vulnerability, right?
Certainly in public. I guess this is sort of going off topic, but this book and my previous novel, which was about sort of a man who had the ability to become invisible, and he had no sort of moral boundaries. So it was the idea of, can the protagonist in the story be an antagonist? Can you make the main character be a bad person? And some of this has to do with my kind of creeping fear that I, and in fact no one, has the ability to decide what we think and what we feel. And that's a very discomforting idea, because the one thing we all want to assume is that we have control over what we think, and that our feelings are based on some kind of rational manifestation of our mind, and that informs the way we feel about things. But as I've gotten older, the world has become more confusing to me. At 41, I'm 41 now, the world seems much more confusing than it did when I was 21. And I think that's partially because I can no longer ignore the reality, which is that I can't control what I think about things. I feel like I can, but I really can't. And once you realize that, it really becomes difficult to believe your own opinion about anything.
I was thinking about this as you as the ethicist, right? And a lot of people who write into the ethicist, they're wrestling, obviously, with quandaries. But a lot of it is about how they are seen by other people, how their own behavior is perceived by others, whether it's the right thing or not. And I wonder if you're very good at that because you suspect your own self of, I don't know, getting over a certain amount of mendacity or a certain amount of sort of wishing at least one baseball player ill.
Well, yeah, you know, that's an interesting thing about the ethicist. If it's really the name of that column that sort of warps everything because it's called the ethicist, there is almost this belief by many of the people who read it that you get that job by somehow being the most ethical person in New York, and that is not the case. What I think I'm able to do is look at situations where I'm not involved as sort of a detached, objective person and sort of break down what an ethical person would do in this scenario, even if it's not necessarily what I would do. But this, you know, what you brought up earlier, it's a very good point. I get lots of questions as the ethicist, you know, like hundreds a day. Most of them are not usable, though, sometimes because they're just really, you know, bizarre and, you know, written by crazy people, sometimes because they're too long or too complicated to use in a column, but most often because the question is not actually about ethics. It's about etiquette, or it's about some internal feeling the person has. You know, a person says, I get on the train in the morning and I find that my natural inclination is to sit by someone of my own race. Does this make me racist? You know, well, that's a very interesting question, and that's certainly a question somebody can talk about. But ethics involves other people. What they're really worried about is sort of what they think in their own mind. They're not hurting anybody by sitting anywhere on the train. You know, it's like it's not having an impact outside of themselves. But etiquette to people is almost like ethics now, because etiquette is what other people are viewing you as. You know, but ethics really should be outside of that. Ethics should exist regardless of how the actions are perceived.
Okay, so how about just a quick little quiz? I'm going to ask you who is more villain.
Okay.
Taylor Swift or Eazy-E?
Well, Eazy-E is trying to project the image of badness. It is a conscious construction. Taylor Swift is attempting to create the illusion of purity. I would say, though I know, you know, I don't personally know either of those people, Taylor Swift is probably closer to an actual villain than Eazy-E.
Okay. Julian Assange or Darth Vader?
Well, Darth Vader is part robot. So that really puts him behind the eight ball. You know, it's like he sort of has a robotic shell where Julian Assange just has sort of a strange haircut. Julian Assange is absolutely convinced that what he is doing is more moral than what the mainstream media does. He is very much a believer that if you put information out, even if it harms one person or 10 people or 100 people, there's a value to that if it ends up saving the lives or transforming the lives of a million people. Darth Vader blew up planets arbitrarily. So I guess Darth Vader is more of a villain.
Okay. Rick Perry or the Sharon Stone character in Basic Instinct?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Rick Perry can't really be a villain by the standards I have set up because he has terrible motives, but they're not informed by anything. Like if we're using this sort of straw man of the person who knows the most but cares the least, he seems to care a lot about a lot of dumb things and doesn't know anything. Now we're putting up against who
is the person? Sharon Stone character.
Sharon Stone. Okay, Sharon Stone's character in Basic Instinct is framed as the villain by the director and the writer. She's very smart. Mm-hmm. She's very cunning, calculating. Uses her sexuality in inappropriate ways. Mm-hmm. But what is her motive? Her motive seems to be, I just want to be interesting, which I guess is worse. It's kind of like Lee Atwater. So I would say Sharon Stone.
Okay. How about Don Henley or Snidely Whiplash?
Okay, that's a good one. Snidely Whiplash had a compulsion. He could not stop himself from tying women to railroad tracks for no reason whatsoever. He just seemed to like to do it. Don Henley really liked to make money. He wanted to take it easy. He wanted to strangle people in discos. I mean, the thing is, if Snidely Whiplash, I guess, isn't a villain, no one is, right? I mean, it's sort of like he's based on the archetype of the silent movie villain. The cover of the book is essentially his outfit. So I guess I will go with Snidely Whiplash, which I guess is sort of an interesting compliment to the Eagles.
Chuck Klosterman, I want to thank you so much for straightening those out for us. I think it's better that people know.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, I try to contribute something to society.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels make you crazy.
Find out more about Chuck Klosterman's new collection of essays. It's called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains. We have a link at wordofmouthradio.org.